You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's programme.
Build the wall! Build the wall! Build the wall. They will.
My guests Linda Yu and Robin Lustig will be discussing whether populist politicians are causing people to become more angry. We'll also be asking whether Bavaria is trying to ban the full face veil because the regional party is worried about the German federal elections. And we've all been to a ridiculous wedding, so should we follow the government of Kashmir's lead and introduce plans to limit their ostentatiousness? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And I promise we're not going to be party poopers in 30 minutes' time, but do stick around for that discussion. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the economist and broadcaster Linda Yu and Robin Lustig, a journalist and the author of Is Anything Happening? Welcome both to the programme. Now, is this the sort of behaviour causing people to become a bit angrier?
We've got a border. The southern border is like a piece of Swiss cheese, and we'll talk about it. We will build the wall, yes. We will build the wall. 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 They will. Oh, we'll build it. We'll build it. Who's going to pay for it? 100%, okay?
Well, a report today has said that populist politicians such as Donald Trump are making the world more dangerous by using divisive and dehumanized rhetoric. The report by Amnesty International has also criticized countries including Turkey and the Philippines, which it says have used narratives of fear, blame and division. But are the likes of Trump and Erdogan causing people to become angry, or have they just tapped into existing anger to further their own political ambitions? Robin, what's your feeling when we hear somebody like Mr. Trump?
My feeling is just one of intense depression. My heart sinks when just listening to that clip then. I mean, I agree with Amnesty International up to a point. I think the fear is already there. What makes populists so dangerous is that they tap into it and they fan the flames. It's like getting a great big pair of bellows and then blowing hard as you can on the embers. They make it, politicians like Donald Trump, in my view, make it acceptable and respectable to be suspicious of, and even worse, to hate your neighbours. And once you encourage that sentiment, which, as I say, may already be there, you then increase the risk of that hatred, that suspicion, that resentment turning into something even more dangerous. And I think all politicians have a responsibility to use words carefully, to try to lessen tensions rather than to heighten them. I know why they do it. It plays well. I mean, no doubt about it. He was elected, after all. But I do think it's very dangerous.
Linda, what we've heard much of over the last few months is people saying, look, there was this kind of well of anger that people have ignored. So, for example, if you had done something about it before, maybe the vote for Brexit would have gone in a different way, that people were very angry about not feeling part of the system, feeling they were denied access to the kinds of services they felt they got in the past because of migration or because of a lack of opportunity. Do you think there was, you know, a kind of a bed of anger that mainstream politicians had often ignored, and these people are fanning, or they're just tapping into?
I'd agree with Robin. I think they're tapping into it, underlying unhappiness with the system, and by their rhetoric, they're fanning it. So what you say is absolutely the case. I think there has been quite a long-standing discontent. So what I'm talking about in terms of America is that median wages haven't risen for 40 years, and there was a sense that some had been left behind, not just by trade, but by technology, by the way that the economy had changed. And one of the correlations that I saw in the polling were that people who felt their personal circumstances had gotten worse over the past few years voted for Trump, and those who felt they had seen their lives improve went for Hillary Clinton. So I think there is there's a complicated set of factors there, but populist politicians like Trump are using that to fuel obviously their ascent, their rise, And I think he feeds off it to an extent. He did a big rally in Melbourne, Florida, which is, by the way, very unusual for a sitting president in the first 100 days to hold a campaign-style rally for. But Trump did it. And I think he feeds off that kind of sentiment as well. But there's no question in my mind, his rhetoric also fans the flames of this discontent. And there used to be a time, I know this probably sounds like I'm being very old-fashioned, but I'm actually just talking about President Obama. words matter when you're the most powerful man in the world. And President Obama was sometimes criticized for speaking too slowly. But my understanding was it's because he measured his words so carefully. And we are only a month away. We've only been a month into this Trump presidency, and that seems like a distant memory. But that used to be the norm for what presidential meant.
Robin, how long do you think people can stay angry? Because what's interesting with Trump, he's riding this wave, and so he's going to deliver all these things. If he did deliver even a quarter of the things he had promised, perhaps some of that anger would be dissipated because people would feel that they were suddenly getting some of the things they'd been demanding for many years. Or are populist politicians just good at creating an anger that is sustained again and again and again?
I think the latter. I think the problem with encouraging that kind of visceral anger is that it can never really be satisfied. Nobody suddenly turns around and says, my goodness, the president has done everything I wanted him to do. He has turned my life around. I now feel so much better than I did before he was elected. That's not how politics works. So the people, I fear, who voted for President Trump will never be satisfied, however well he does in their terms. Therefore, they will always want more. They will always want somebody else to blame. I mean, I think Linda puts her finger on something very important. The difference between the way Obama used words and the way Trump uses words is that Obama tried to make people think of what was best about themselves and their country. Trump does the opposite. He makes them feel he's called America, or parts of America, a cesspit, a swamp. He uses words like carnage. He makes people feel worse about themselves and about their country. And I think that's a really, really depressing, negative, and dangerous thing to do.
Linda, it's true that, Obama did do that, but he did leave a very divided nation and a nation where we see, terrible violence within many African-American communities. Whether that's from police or from other people within their own communities often. Now, what this report is saying that these people do divide the nation because there tends to be somebody who's to blame for the situation you're in. And here in America, we see it's normally the Chinese or it's normally the Mexicans who are up to no good. Now, how much do you think that he realizes the danger he's doing? Because we've seen just today him actually make a speech saying or comment at least that he is very opposed to what's happening to Jewish people since he came to power, an increase in attacks. Do you think that he believes that those people should be attacked, or that that's just an unfortunate outcome of his kind of overblown rhetoric?
I think it's probably the latter, but I wouldn't presume to know what President Trump is thinking. I think that's one of the uncertainties about his presidency. We shall see. But it's certainly, I think, the case that if you look across America, this campaign, obviously, he's been in office for a month, but the presidential race, the election, has been going on for nearly 2 years. And there are reported rises in incidents of hate crimes, of xenophobia. And I think that does have to do with how heated some of these rhetoric has become, how angry people are. And I wouldn't say it's obviously simply Trump. There's other factors as well. But I think there has been a less of a tolerance in a society which traditionally is known as a land of immigrants and wouldn't necessarily condone even the rhetoric, much less the act. But I think what we probably should also bear in mind is it's easier to scapegoat the Mexicans, the Chinese. And if you're looking for an outlet for your anger, it's easier to go for somebody who's different. Or in the case of economics, it's always easier to pin your economic failures on another country rather than look at what's gone wrong in your own country. And that, I think, is not specific to America. I think that is a pretty common feature of quite a lot of governments that have struggled economically.
Can I just say, Andrew, this argument that a lot of Trump supporters say about the divided nation and how Obama left a legacy of a divided America. America has always been a divided nation. You look at the results of presidential elections going back decades. The vote is always 50-something percent to 40-something percent, the low 50s to the high 40s, sometimes barely a percentage point between the two. Ask any African American in America whether they think America is more divided now than it was. I mean, for goodness sake, the Civil War wasn't that long ago in historical terms. It's always been a divided country. I think to try and say Obama has made us a divided country is just absurd.
It's interesting because, you know, you wouldn't say that we had the same kind of populist politics here writ large. You know, we have obviously populist politicians, but it feels that every country almost you go to now, there is this tension, a greater divide, a feeling of blame and divisiveness. And I wonder what makes it finally dissipate. There are two things that come to mind. I remember working on a newspaper here in the UK maybe 15 years ago, and there was a very genuine discussion about it was the time of Blair. I remember saying, well, actually, when you look at the Conservatives and Labour and the Liberal Democrats, they've all got the same policies. They're all exactly the same. There's a centre ground. The politics of right and left have gone forever. We've all ended up in a nice middle class spot in the middle. Now, when you look at that 15 years later, that's almost You can't believe it. So is it just a kind of a tide that happens with the economy? Or do you need to happen something even worse to happen? You know, that the only other times I can think where it dissipates almost immediately is in shame, where, you know, for example, after the Second World War, you can hardly believe in 1950 the Germans you meet talking about democracy and building an amazing democratic nation were 5 years before many of them caught up within, the Nazi machine. What makes it go away, do you think, Robin?
Well, I think the short answer and a simplistic answer would be economic well-being. When people feel that their lives are getting better, when they feel that they have enough money to live a decent life, that they will bequeath a decent life to their children, who will have an even better life than they themselves have had, then their level of contentment is greater than it is in times like now, when wages are stagnant, when economic uncertainty is very high. The big difference between the kind of UK society that you describe of 10 or 15 years ago and now is that it's either side of the financial crash. And I think the crash persuaded people that their contentment, such as it was built on a very, very flimsy foundation. We all nearly lost everything at that moment. If the world had spun into a depression, we would have all been much worse off than we are now. And I think that scared people. And so they wanted to have somebody to blame. For reasons of politics, they didn't blame the bankers and the people who'd made all the reckless loans and been responsible for the crash. They looked for somebody else to blame. And the politicians encouraged them to blame minorities, to blame foreigners, to blame immigrants. It's easy to do. It taps into, as we were already saying, a pre-existing fear. And on it goes.
Well, we're going to stay with the theme, but we're going to move on now because we're going to head to Bavaria. Well, there are suggestions that a full ban should be brought in on face veils. The German state has a small Muslim population, but officials want to make it illegal to wear the veil at universities, government buildings and schools. So why are they doing it? Well, critics are arguing that it's got nothing more than to do with regional voting and courting votes ahead of Germany's federal elections. Well, still with me are Linda Yu and Robin Lustig. Linda, would you be a supporter of bringing in a ban on the full face veil?
I'm a supporter of allowing people to choose. And I think there is a religious reason for having the face veil. And I think the reasons for why the Bavarian government are introducing it is probably quite related to the Chancellor Angela Merkel saying just a few months ago that she supported a ban on face veils consistent with German constitutional law. Now, whether that's in response to what they think of as needing to have more homogeneity, or it has to do with her fighting an election against an anti-immigrant party that had been gaining in the polls, I would have to say for most politicians, you would never rule out that as a motivation. So I think there is obviously, there are issues around integration. I think that was the argument put forward by the Bavarian government.
But isn't that a good argument in a way? That's a fair argument for Bavarians to say, look, you know, these are families who've decided that they would like to lead their lives in Bavaria, and we have a bit of a culture here. You know, would you like to be part of it? And there is a feeling that for many people in Germany, if you say, okay, I'm not going to go out to work, I'm going to live behind a veil, I don't want my children going to the swimming pool, I don't want them hanging out with, you know, the German boys at school, then you have no chance of integration at any level ever, and particularly if you're a woman.
I would say that integration has a lot more to do with being a productive member of society. It doesn't have to do with how they choose to live their lives. There's actually a quote about your rights from Benjamin Franklin, since we were talking about America a few moments ago. He says that your rights extend as far as my nose, but until it hits my nose, you're free to live life as you choose. And so I think there are conversations to be had around how you can help everyone, whether they're migrants or of a different religion than the dominant religion, integrate and live productively in a society. But I don't think that has to do with dictating whether or not they should wear a burqa or a hijab. I just think that's going beyond the tip of your nose.
You know, I find it a very complicated argument, but what's your thought, Robin? Because it does strike me that, you know, if you go into, you know, your local, you know, Sparkasse in Munich, you know, and somebody's wearing a full face veil behind the counter, that's complicated for many older German people who, you know, they want to be open-minded, but they just have no way of breaching that divide.
And how often does it happen? On an infinitesimal number of occasions. I saw the Bavarian interior minister asked yesterday, I think it was, how many state employees will this proposal actually affect? And the answer was none, not one. I find it absurd that governments think that it is part of their job to legislate on how people dress. I grew up in the 1960s, which was a time when men started to wear their hair long and women started to wear their skirts very short. A lot of people were outraged by both those developments. They thought it showed that society was going to the dogs, that it showed that standards were being lowered. Would anybody seriously suggest that it should be made illegal for men to wear long hair or for women to wear short skirts? The niqab, the full face veil, is worn by a tiny number of Muslims worldwide. Largely those who live in the Gulf states, where there are very, very small populations, let it be said. Even fewer of them live in Europe or in other Western countries. This is a fake problem which does not need government action. But it's a disguise for something else. But it's a disguise for anti-Muslim sentiment and a way in which politicians want to try to meet what they think is this wave of anti-Islamic sentiment rather than to confront it.
But when you go to, say, France, where they have a different situation in the sense that they have a long tradition of trying to keep everything secular, keep religion out of everything, which can include, you know, Christian symbols and Sikh symbols and all sorts of things. Do you have more empathy there with people who say, look, you know, the reason we don't want people wearing a headscarf or veil in a university or in a government situation is not because, you know, we're opposed to what you do outside of this institution, but actually here in French tradition, it's totally secular.
I don't think teachers should wear a full face veil because I think a lot of their pupils will find it off-putting and sometimes frightening. I don't think witnesses in courts should wear a full face veil because their identity is a crucial part of the proceedings. Other than that, and one or two other situations in which security is an issue, I see no reason at all why people should not be allowed to dress as they wish. It's not a major problem in France. There are many, many Muslim women who wear the hijab, the scarf. There are a tiny number of women who wear the niqab. As I say, it's a fake problem.
Linda, just out of interest in you, it's a strange topic because many liberal people fight for the right for women to wear the full veil. But to many people who look at the situation, they feel that it's, in a way, a thing that stops women being part of broader society. The very kind of thing that you think liberal women would never fight to defend. Why? Yeah, I'm guessing here, but I'm presuming you're a moderate, middle of the road kind of person, like we all are. Why do you fight for women's rights to cover up, to not be part of, you said you like to be part of society, but many of these people are forced to withdraw from society. Why do you fight to defend one of the biggest symbols of that?
I think one of the things that Europeans talk about quite a lot, but actually Brits don't talk about so much, are what are values, European values. And I think one of the values is the freedom to dress as you wish. As Robin said, if he wished to wear long hair, I'm not in any position to advocate that he ought to cut his hair. And so the
Robin hasn't got long hair.
No, he doesn't.
But he's got a beard. There are some people who would want to force me to shave a beard off.
But, I think... So within Western societies, I think the only values that we can espouse are the ones that we understand where they've come from, and they they underpin the way we live our lives, which is a freedom to choose. Now, the complicated situation behind what a Muslim religion or a culture would dictate, that's much beyond what I think you and I, or perhaps even the Bavarian government, is equipped to do. I think all they can do is to uphold the European values of free choice.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Linda Yu, and Robin Lustig. Coming up, should we impose limits on lavish weddings? Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Now, we've all been to a wedding that's been a bit much. The one where everyone from the groom's third cousin to the bride's old boss has been invited. So has the government in Kashmir come up with a clever way of making sure that wedding parties don't get too out of hand? Officials in the Indian administered region have stated that brides-to-be can't invite more than 500 guests. And the number of food courses is also being curbed. Well, still with me are Robin Lustig and Linda Yu. Do you think 500 guests is actually capping this in a sensible way?
I think I must move in the wrong circles. I don't think I've ever been to a wedding with anything like 500 guests. Look, if I don't believe that government should stop women wearing the niqab, I certainly don't think governments should tell people how many guests they can have at their wedding. It's got nothing to do with a government. And if they waste food, then that is certainly antisocial and should be discouraged, but it shouldn't be illegal. I understand entirely that ostentatious weddings may seem to some people to be distasteful, antisocial, certainly a waste of people's money, but it's their decision. If that's how they want to spend their money, it's their right to spend it that way.
Linda, are you all for the big wedding?
I quite like a big wedding. They're lovely to attend. I mean, limiting to 7 courses for an Indian wedding, it's pretty extreme. But I mean, I completely agree with Robin. I think that unless you're talking about wanting to advocate some type of nudge policy, which is obviously what they're doing here. They're trying to essentially nudge people into being more prudent. But if they're spending doesn't affect, that it's not state subsidized, it's not anti-competitive, it doesn't have any negative impact except for social impact, then the only argument I would see is that the government is trying to nudge behavior, but it's pretty heavy-handed in the way that it's actually done it in terms of a ban. I have a better suggestion, which is these days, on social media, if you wanted to out somebody as being ostentatious, completely living beyond, you know, reasonable means, wasting food, snap some photos, post it on Twitter.
Absolutely. Name and shame. Yeah.
The trouble is they're all doing it themselves. They're not waiting for you to post the pictures. They want to prove themselves that they've spent all that money.
If a few major politicians had modest weddings, for example, and said, I'm only going to invite a dozen people to my wedding and we're only going to have three courses, that would set an example, wouldn't it? Hold your breath.
Well, we're going to stick with the food, but only one course now, because the president of Iceland has been forced to clarify his outspoken stance on pizza toppings. Now, Gunnar T. Johannesson caused a political storm in the country after saying that he was fundamentally opposed to pineapple atop the dough-based snack. Pineapple man, Robin?
Nah. Not on pizzas. I mean, I love pineapples, but please.
You sound just like him.
Yeah, but, you know, he's had a very bad rap in the media, I have to say. He said if he could, he would ban pineapple on pizza. He has since clarified that he's very glad that he doesn't have that power. He was expressing a personal preference. Maybe he shouldn't have done. He's the president. Maybe his personal preferences have nothing to do with anything. My personal preference is no pineapple on pizza, but if you want pineapple on yours, be my guest.
I wonder, Linda, that most of those terrible toppings, I think, emanated probably from the UK. There's a kind of period, I think, in the kind of 60s and 70s where we didn't know anything about Italian food and we just went to the cupboard and opened tins and empty. So sweet corn ended up and Spam ended up and all, well, Spam.
We've moved on from there. Come on, be fair.
I'm saying in the 60s and 70s, you still see quite a lot of, you know, corn and you still see eggs and all sorts of things chucked on. How do you like your pizza?
Yeah, well, actually, I like it with virtually anything on it, so including pineapple. But what's interesting about the Icelandic president is that it caused such a furore that he did have to clarify his response. And actually, his response turned out to be much more profound. He said, presidents should not have unlimited power. Do not give me the power to ban your pizza toppings. That is not a country I want to live in. And so we started off talking about pineapples on pizza, but actually it's a much bigger lesson, which is you should never allow a single person's dictate to affect the eating choices of the rest of that 300,000 people in that nation.
And keeping with the theme of the day, perhaps he could have a word with the state authorities in Bavaria and say, pineapple on pizza, niqab on women's heads, it's all the same, butt out, nothing to do with you.
Now, the interesting thing is, I don't think they have, well, they do have hot houses in Iceland, so on the thermals. So
yeah,
they
where
can,
are they getting their pineapples
exactly.
from anyway?
But we went to Iceland recently with Monocle, and we went to a restaurant where they served more interesting things you could have had as toppings. I'm not heartily recommending. They had puffins, puffin burgers, genuine puffin burgers, I'm afraid, minke whale burgers.
Okay.
So maybe they've got some more options for their toppings.
Fine. Okay. I mean, you know, whatever, as they say. if that's what they want, fine. Go for it.
I think he actually advocated seafood on pizza, which is completely unsurprising in Iceland.
Well, exactly. Makes sense. I'm not sure what the Neapolitans would say about that.
But a puffin pizza could be quite a goer. In fact, our colleague upstairs, Josh Fennett, he almost went into trouble for... because he did eat everything on the menu.
Right.
And I'm not quite sure that was very good when he came back to London.
No, well, maybe
somebody
not,
from the
maybe
Puffin
not.
Protection Society.
There
I
are people who think
offense.
We should be eating a lot more insects. Maybe we should put locusts on our pizzas. I don't
or
know.
Tarantulas.
Yeah,
sautéed.
Yeah.
Well, my guests have discussed everything today, including...
time for dinner.
including pizza toppings. So thanks to Robin Lustig and Linda Yu for joining me here on Midori House. But that's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Tom Fears. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's lots of music up next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Danny Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. And tomorrow, tune in for a special version of The Urbanist that will be coming live here from Midori House in front of a quite a grand audience who are going to be coming to talk about the future of city building and innovative ways of making everything from skyscrapers to cleaning up our rivers. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 hours London time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.